Good morning. Well, I am excited to be able to share God's word with you this morning. If you've been with us, you know that we've been in the book of Daniel, and we are going to camp out in Daniel 6 today. So if you want to bring that up on your phone or look in the Journey Bible, that's where we're going to camp out this morning. But I want to start out this morning talking about my oldest daughter, Kyla. Now, we dropped her off in Phoenix for college a few weeks ago. So I say she's fair game for sermon analogies, right? I mean, she's on the other side of the country, so take note, guys. But when Kyla was a toddler, she treasured three things more than anything else in this world. It was her baby, her binky, and her blankie. She loved these three things, and she took them everywhere she went. It gave her security, it gave her safety. And the interesting thing is, what she cherished most and revered most was also the same very thing that she feared losing the most, especially at bedtime. So if she didn't have all three things at bedtime, she was not going to sleep, right? I mean, she would search all over for it, and if she couldn't find it, she would get us searching all over for it because we wanted her to go to bed. So how does fear turn a sweet little toddler into a bloodhound looking for sausage? Really? Right? And the interesting thing is that in the base of our brain, there's a cluster of cells that looks like a nut called the amygdala. And this cluster of cells was originally believed to regulate our fear response. Like, you know, if a bear was attacking us, we would run, right? Fight or flight. But what we know now is that even as toddlers, even in her young age that Kyla was, our amygdala is also involved with evaluating the things that we see in our environment and placing a value to it, and then prioritizing our actions, our emotional response to that value. And why am I telling you all this? Because most of the time, we don't even know that this is happening. It's happening at a subconscious level, deep within our mind. And so we don't know what's going on, and it's at the core of who we are as humans. It's how God made us. So fear, a lot of times, will direct our action and how we respond to certain things. So as we read through Daniel 6 today, I want you to pay a special attention to how fear drives action throughout this passage, okay? Last week, Norm taught us through Daniel 5, which illustrated the sovereignty of God. Sovereignty of God and what happens when we challenge it and ridicule it. It ended with King Belshazzar being slain for dishonoring God and challenging his sovereignty. And the Babylonian kingdom was then taken over by Darius the Mede. Now we're going to start chapter 6. And we're going to actually look at the relationship between Darius the Mede and Daniel and some of the other leaders in the empire. Now, keep in mind that Daniel was now serving the Babylonian Empire for 70 years at this point. He's an old man. I mean, he was taken at age 17, so he was probably, you know, 87 years old. So he was an old man. And during this entire time, he's seen kings come and go, you know, multiple kings come and go, but what has stayed constant has been his fear of God and his reverence for God and his faithful prayers for God to restore Israel and to send them back home. So he's now serving King Darius, who really was kind of more of a governor under King Cyrus. And King Darius had a lot of land. He had a lot of land, and he wanted to see it flourish. But there's no way that he could have kept tabs on everything that was happening in the kingdom. So what did he do? He assigned 120 satraps to oversee it. And satraps were kind of like mayors, if you will. They were mayors that were responsible for security of the place and for collecting taxes for the king. And then above the satraps, supervising the satraps, he had three high officials, of which Daniel was one of them. So that takes us to verse 3 in Daniel 6, 3. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. He was good at what he did. He was really good. Good enough that the king noticed it, said, hey, I want him to take over everything. Now, if you work anywhere and you were working with a bunch of people and one gets promoted, you know what generally happens, right? This is no different. Verse 4. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. So he showed great character, right? He had integrity. So the other two officials and mayors were jealous. They were so jealous of Daniel. So they were trying to figure out how they could conspire against Daniel. Recognizing that he was a man of integrity, they realized the only way that they could get rid of him is if they came up with a law that negatively affected how he lived out his faith in God. Because he knew that Daniel wouldn't waver in how he practiced his faith. And they needed a law they knew that Daniel couldn't obey. So you can imagine how the satraps must have felt and other two administrators must have felt. When Daniel was one of their own, doing the same job they were doing, all of a sudden the king wants to promote him. I mean, what makes him so special, right? Like, we should get a shot at this. Now notice that their motive for planning this trap for Daniel was power. What they revered most was power, and the thing that they feared losing the most was power. They feared losing power to Daniel, so they did whatever they could, regardless of the means or the morality, to gain the power back. And this is so much of how our world works even today, isn't it? So the other leaders appealed to King Darius, and they appealed to his pride, right? And they went to him and suggested that he enact a law that anyone that prayed to any god or human being during the next 30 days, other than King Darius, would be thrown into the lion's den. So King Darius did just that. He said, all right, that sounds pretty good. So imagine that, my guess is that King Darius loved the idea of being seen as the only mediator to God, right? Oh, they can pray to me, or they can worship me. And he wanted the approval of his subjects, like most kings do. So as a result, he agreed to the edict for fear of losing those things. So now let's look at Daniel's response, verse 10. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Now remember, he's done this for 70 years. And I think I did the math. It was something like he's done this on the ballpark more than 75,000 times, right? So he's done this time and time again. This is what Daniel does. He's been faithful to it. Verse 11. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. Daniel didn't go into hiding, did he? He didn't go pray in his closet. He didn't denounce God to save his life. He didn't worry or try to fix it himself. He didn't try to fight for power or control. He still had the spirit of gratitude to God despite his life being threatened. He still humbled himself and asked God for help. So Daniel's response was completely different, wasn't it? His fear was not in what man was doing to him. So Daniel's accusers are like, aha, we caught you doing it, right? And then he went to King Darius and to report that Daniel was ignoring his edict. And he was violating and still praying three times a day to his God. But what was interesting was Darius' response. Verse 14, when the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to King Darius and said to him, remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him in the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve, continually rescue you." His officers, the king's officers, basically tricked him into signing an irrevocable decree. Darius knew that he couldn't get Daniel out of this predicament. And really, he only had himself to blame for putting Daniel in that position in the first place. I don't know about you, but have you ever had an experience where it just resulted in such mental and emotional anguish? Like where your stomach is churning, your heart is racing, your soul just hurts? I have. You know, we've lost a kid or two along the way. We have five, so you know, it's bound to happen, right? But yeah, it just your stomach just churns and you're just anguished. And this is what Darius felt. You know, it's interesting that despite Darius being a pagan king, he sees value in Daniel's God. He sees value in Daniel's God, and he admires that Daniel models integrity in his practice of faith. He even says, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." So he's a fan. He's a fan of Daniel's God. He doesn't own it yet, but he's a fan. So they sealed the entrance with a stone to make sure that Daniel couldn't escape. And the king was really distraught throughout the night. He didn't want to be entertained. He couldn't sleep. And as soon as dawn broke, he rushed out to the lion's den. Verse 20 says, "When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, 'Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? And Daniel answered, "May the king live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I done anything wrong before you, your majesty." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. The king then had all Daniel's accusers and their families thrown into the den where they all died. I believe it actually says that their bones were crushed before they even hit the ground. Now, this may seem cruel for the king to do that, but this was a common practice by the Persians to punish the men and their entire families who falsely accused their victims by receiving the same fate as what they had wanted for their victims. It was God's mercy that saved Daniel, and it was his justice that allowed the Persians to carry out their punishment on Daniel's accusers. And after Daniel's accusers were punished, King Darius makes this proclamation. And this is, remember, this guy was just a fan before, and this is what he says. "Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, 'May you prosper greatly.'" That's verse 25. "I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So what's interesting is that Daniel's end game was not to influence the king. That's not why he did what he did. He simply feared and revered God and lived a life of competency and character. He was good at what he did, and he lived his life consistently reflecting his beliefs regardless of the circumstance. And as a result, you see this transformation in Darius from being just a fan of Daniel's God, to truly revering God and putting him in the highest place. So what can we learn from Daniel 6? And I'm going to just be transparent with you. I had a full message prepared, ready to go. And then at 3 a.m. this morning, I had an appointment with the Holy Spirit. And that actually happens pretty often before sermons, but this one was a little bit different. And God said, I just want you to focus on this one point. And I was like, well, usually in most sermons we have three, you know, points, and we do, you know, it's going to be really short. Nope, just one point. So I'm just going to be obedient. But in the brevity of it, I don't want you to lose sight of how important this is, because everything rides on this. And I do believe that there are some here this morning that need to hear this. And you'll see what I mean in a second. So what can we learn from Daniel 6? Daniel feared God more than he feared man, and so should we. Daniel feared God more than he feared man, and so should we. You know, it's interesting that it doesn't directly say that in this text, does it? But Daniel modeled it through his actions, that he still worshiped God despite his life being threatened. And Darius even confirms it in his decree when he says that everyone must fear and reverence Daniel's God. He modeled that for everyone. I mean, Daniel had a lot to fear. Approval of others, loss of his job, loss of power, loss of his potential loss of his life. He had a lot to fear. So the question is, how did he stay so calm despite his dire circumstances? Wasn't he anxious? You know, even as I'm speaking right now, my wife is returning from a counseling conference where they were just talking yesterday about how anxiety and fear is at epidemic proportions right now in this country. And it was already big before, but especially after COVID, 50% of people deal with fear and anxiety at one point or another. One in two. And if that's you right now, and you feel alone, don't. Because we all, or most of us, at some point, have experienced that. You know, and fear and anxiety is real, and it's complex. So I don't really want to diminish someone else's experience, nor do I want to oversimplify things. But I do want to dig into the spiritual aspects of fear and anxiety and give hope to those that are struggling with it. I've heard this definition of anxiety before and fear that I love. And it's this. Anxiety and fear is an over-evaluation of your circumstances and under-evaluation of your resources to handle it. Again, I'll say that one more time. It's an over-evaluation of your circumstances, right? So your reality is distorted, and an under-evaluation of your resources to handle it. I just can't do it. Or it's all on me, and I'm not enough, right? So there are two parts to this. The over-evaluation of your circumstances, maybe what if everyone rejects me? What if my boss doesn't like what I do and I'm seen as a failure? What if my parents don't approve of this? What if, and it goes on and on and on, right? The what-ifs never end. And then in addition to that, you don't feel like you are equipped to take care of it. I can't do this on my own. I am not good enough. I am not smart enough. I am not, you fill in the blank. So how did Daniel stay calm during this time? How was he not anxious? And his circumstances were not great, right? And he certainly had no control over managing those circumstances. He wasn't going to change the king's mind as it was happening, right? He couldn't change the law. So how did he stay calm? Well, what's interesting is the answers were actually found in King Darius' decree. You see, there is nothing we should fear more than God, who is capable of opening and closing the mouths of lions, even lions. So whatever difficult circumstances we are facing right now, we have a God who is big enough to handle it. So we get anxious when we focus on our own ability to handle our circumstances instead of focusing on a God who has infinite power, right? The second thing is that in King Darius' decree, is that he had an eternal perspective, realizing that the circumstances change, and this life is temporary, but God's kingdom will never be destroyed, and his rule will never end. So when we look at our elevated or over-evaluated sense of our circumstance, you know, our distorted reality, this puts things into perspective when we look at it in an eternal perspective. So we can have hope whether he fixes things now or he fixes it in eternity. Doesn't always mean that we're going to live or that bad things won't happen, but we can have the hope that whether he does it now or does it in eternity, that he is in charge of all that. And so we get anxious when we think that this life is all that matters. When all these issues, think about some issues that you were anxious about 10 years ago. They seem kind of silly now, don't they? A lot of them. But at that time, they were right front and center in front of us, and we just could not get around those issues because they were so big in our lives. But when you look at it from an eternal perspective, or even just 10 years down the road, it doesn't seem as big. So imagine God, who can see the eternal perspective. He sees things a little bit different sometimes. And the third is this, that when we focus on what God has already done in the past, it reminds us of God's character and what we can trust him to do in the future. I'll say it one more time. When we focus on what God has done in the past, it reminds us of God's character and what we can trust him to do in the future. Where Darius talked about, he rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. So we get anxious when we forget what God has already done in our lives and through the work of Jesus. And this is where reading scripture regularly is so important. As we see what God has done through generation after generation, it helps us and gives us faith and trust in what he will do in the future. Because our God never changes. I love this quote from Oswald Chambers, and it sums it up so well. The remarkable thing about God is that when you fear God, you fear nothing else. Whereas if you do not fear God, you fear everything else. So when we understand and we are reverent to a God, we understand that he is in a high place, that he is in control, and we have a high view of him, then there is nothing to fear. Because if God is for you, who can be against you, right? So I was listening to this worship song a few months ago. Actually, it was probably almost a half a year ago now. It's by the Passion Worship Team, and it's called More Like Jesus. And I was listening to it, and it was really good. I thought it was really powerful. And then it got to the chorus. And the chorus wrecked me. The chorus wrecked me. And the chorus says, if more of you means less of me, take everything. Yes, all of you is all I need. Take everything. And it wrecked me for months because I wanted so bad to be able to say that and mean it. But I knew in my heart that there were things that I wasn't ready to give up to him. See, I found myself sporadically having moments of fear and anxiety with thoughts of what would happen. I don't know what I would do if I lost Allison. I mean, I love my amazing, kind, supportive, loving wife. And I just couldn't imagine a life without her. Or my children. What if I lost one of my children to cancer or something else? I don't know what I would do if. And these aren't bad things to love your kids or your wife. But God had to do a work in my heart, and he continues to do a work to truly recognize his infinite value compared to the things of this world, even good things in this world, and to fear and revere him more than anything else. Paul says in Philippians, yes, everything else is worthless when compared with the infinite value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake, I have discarded everything else. counting it as garbage, so that I could gain Christ and become one with him. His desire is for us to view him in that high of a state, that even the great things in life that we enjoy are pale in comparison to his value. So because of how our brains are wired, like we talked about at the beginning, we have to do the deep inner work of digging into these fears and surrendering them to God, because, as we said, fear drives action. So they can either drive us towards God, or they can direct us apart from God without even knowing it sometimes. It could be years down the road before we even recognize it. Even good things like marriage and parenting can lead us astray if we put it above God. And for those of you that struggle with fear and anxiety, I just want you to know that you're not alone. You're not alone. And most of us have been there at one time or another. There is no shame in the struggle. But I think that sometimes as Christians or Christ followers that you get, oh, well, I really shouldn't be struggling with this because that must mean that I don't have enough faith or I don't have enough whatever. There is no shame in the struggle. But what you don't want to do is to isolate yourself. There's a purpose for that fear. And there's a purpose there to drive you into greater dependency to God. Now, I'm going to have Zach come up here as we close. And I don't know if you've been following the news, but in Afghanistan, the church in Afghanistan is in an interesting predicament. So just prior to the Taliban taking over Afghanistan again, the church has made a decision to declare, publicly register their churches and the people in the churches with the government. And fully knowing that that would put a bullseye on their back. So you may think about this situation or hear about this, and you might say, like, why would they do that? That just seems so crazy that they would put themselves in harm's way, right? I mean, they existed before. Why would they do that now? They basically, and when I read about this, they basically said that they came to a place in their lives where they realized that their reverence for God and their desire to declare their faith for Christ for generations to come. Because once you've declared that, that means your children, your children's children, and children's children's children would be labeled as Christ followers, as Christians. It would be on their official documentation and everything. That desire outweighed any fear for them, even at the cost of their life. And while this may appear like a dire circumstance for them, and it is, let's not lose sight of how amazing and inspiring this is. It's a modern-day Daniel 6. They had an option to flee from their fear, but instead they let fear lead them to greater faith. So whatever it is that you're fearing right now, whatever situation or circumstance that's happening where you're doubting yourself and saying, I can't do it, or I'm just not good enough, or I can't get there and I don't know what to do. Know that God has allowed this fear to exist, to draw you to depend on him, to trust him, to cling to him. And as you do, you will find his comfort, his refuge, his faithfulness, awaiting to free you from the shackles of fear and anxiety and to transform your life.